in order to learn chapters 9 and 10, I gave you actually an outline on the sheet. We have to deal with a major issue here. Basically, there are two themes that we're going to see in chapters 9 and 10. One theme is the issue of intermarriage, and the other is Ezra's leadership style. How does he deal with problems that he faces? Now, I want to state a preface which is going to apply both when we see these chapters and then when we come back to this issue in Nehemiah, because this is going to be a major issue in Nehemiah as well. Everything that we're going to see here is going to speak very strongly to a rejection of Jewish marriages with people who are not Jewish. We're going to talk about the halachic issues in such a situation, but recognizing that it is rare to find a Jewish family where this is not a practical issue, I hope that anything that we say will not offend. It's not meant to take the issue lightly. It is not meant to address the issue glibly or to paint everybody with one brush. But this is here in the text, and you have to know that you can't learn Ezra and Nehemiah without addressing this, at least in the sense of what it meant for the Jews who had come back from exile in Babel. So you see on your sheet the outline in source number 4. It starts with the report. Ezra learns that, in fact, Jews are married to others. We'll talk about who they married, when they married, in a little bit. Ezra is going to appeal to God, and that's going to be the bulk of chapter 9. Then we get the national response in chapter 10, Ezra's display of grief, a major national decision in chapter 10, followed by separation of the couples who had intermarried. Whether that's all of the couples or only some of them, we're going to have to see. But you should know, like I said, this is coming back in Nehemiah. So whatever they did here was not the end of the problem. Susan?
When you say Ezra's prayer to God,
yeah,
is he praying to God to stop the intermarriage?
Well, that's what we have to see when we get there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, because, I mean, how does he think God could do that?
Wait and see.
Okay.
Wait and see. In short, he's not looking to God to stop the intermarriage. No, I'll tell you that. That I can already tell you.
Even though I thought I would wait for one second, when you say a report about the intermarriage, he finds out about it.
Yes.
I would have thought he knows about it.
So a little bit depends on when this marriage is taking place. What are these marriages? There are two possibilities, right? Either these marriages are ones which took place already in Babylon, in which case you're right. I would have thought he lived there, he would know. But the alternative is that these are marriages that are taking place in the land now. And in fact, Ezra shows up and somebody comes to him and says, you know, we have an issue here. So we'll have to see which we're talking about. So in order to do this, though, there's a separate passage which we have to learn. And I apologize to the couple of people who were here when we learned Malachi 5 years ago. But you have to go back to Malachi in order to do this. So go back to page 1400. Not Malachi, Malachi.
Malachi.
Yes. We're on page 1431. You may recall when we started Ezra, we noted that the Gemara actually has a view that identifies Malachi with Ezra. Malachi historically is a prophet in the second generation of the Second Temple, the time, in other words, when Ezra shows up. He's not there in the initial group. Haggai and Zechariah are the Nevi'im at that point. We find no mention of Malachi at that stage. Malachi speaks to the Jews after that. He is the last of our recorded prophets. The end of prophecy and the end of the part of Tanakh called Nevi'im is Malachi. It's recorded in Treyasar, that book of the 12 smaller books of prophets. So Malachi, one of the reasons why we identify Malachi with Ezra is because Malachi addresses this intermarriage theme, which Ezra does as well. In general, Malachi has a theme of infidelity. That's a major point for Malachi on multiple levels. He, in chapter 2, accuses the Levi'im of breaking their covenant with God. That's one level of disloyalty. Here, he's going to accuse the men of breaking their covenant with their wives. And then he's going to move on to talk about the national covenant with God and breaking that covenant with God. So he has multiple levels of this disloyalty. And here he's going to address the males involved. We'll talk about later why it's males as opposed to females. That we'll come back to. But that's what he's going to do. So before we even see the verses, actually, let's take the question now. Take a look at source number 6 on your sheet, and you see what Rashi says regarding these intermarriages. Rashi writes, "Shenasu nashim nochriyot bibavel." Bibavel. They married foreign women in Bavel, in Babylon. Vafilo Akonim, even the Kohanim did, Kemosha Mefurish Besefer, as is recorded in the text in Ezra, Rabba Seinu Amri Malachi Ezra, and our sages identify Malachi, who speaks about it there, with Ezra in our book. So Rashi believes this dates back to Bavel. Yeah.
So
Julie.
If they're both the same prophet, why not use the same name? Or one of them, Ezra 1 and Ezra 2?
Right, so the funny thing is that we don't actually know for sure that he was ever meant to be called Malachi. Go back for a second to the beginning of the book of Malachi, it's only one page before that, and read the opening sentence and recognize that it isn't necessarily saying his name is Malachi at all. Mm-hmm. Right?
No, but if it's Ezra, why not just say this is Ezra? Or why not say Malachi?
But there's no name. Ezra. Right, there's no name.
But why name?
Ezra, why? Why is it left anonymous? Yes. Maybe because it's already Ezra's prophecy, would be one. So that could be why. But you're right.
Why not say this is Ezra's prophecy?
Right. I understand what you're asking. I think you can give answers for it, but at the end of the day, what the Gemara is really trying to do is not necessarily to make a historical statement, as much as to say, look at the themes that are associated and who's operating there at the same time, and therefore make that kind of a link. That's true in general whenever we ask these questions, but we know for historical fact that there were figures at the time who operated by multiple names for whatever reason. Whatever the convenience was, we had it. Whether the names are subtle differences, like Yirmiyah, Yirmiyahu, Yeshaya, Yeshayahu, things like that, which today would really annoy us, but in their society, with the way literacy worked in those days, it wasn't a big deal to alter it. Or whether you talk about Daniel Belshazzar, right, where he's given another name. This is your Babylon name. Mm-hmm. You know, this is your Jewish name, this is your Babylon name. You had a phenomenon of renaming people for various reasons. Yeshaya and his kids, who we kind of hope got renamed at some point, because otherwise it just wouldn't fit in the Scantron place in school. The Pele Yoetz Kel Gibor Avi Yatzar Shalom is just a mouthful, you know? They had a nickname, exactly, Malachi. So Rashi believes that these are intermarriages that are going on in Babylon, but take a look at source number 7. The Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which says no, and makes it a lot more understandable in terms of Ezra not knowing about this. Bishah Sha'alu Yisrael min HaGolah. When Israel came out of the exile, Nispachmu Pnei HaNashim min HaShemesh V'inichu Osan. The women's faces were blackened by the sun, and the men, right, and the men left them. V'holchu lehem v'nasu nashim amoniyot. The men married the Ammonite women. And the women surrounded the altar and they cried, and that's a reference to what we'll see in Malachi. Husha Malachi Omer, Vizos Shenis Ta'asu. This Malachi is going to say, we'll have to see this more, this is the second thing that you do, meaning Shnia L'Shitim, because this isn't the first time that Jews have taken foreign wives. There is this mass incident in Shitim with the daughters of Moab and Midian. There's more to say about this medrash. I don't want to go into this medrash in depth. The association with Shitim is fascinating, but not for right now. But the point for us is that this supports the idea that actually the intermarriages weren't a Babylonian phenomenon. The intermarriages are actually after they come back into the land. Remember that you have all these other populations surrounding them, and that's when they start marrying among their neighbors, whether it's because there were sunburn issues,
interesting the way they grew.
Yeah.
I mean, not that they...
I don't know what to do with it. I just shrug. I don't know what to do with it.
Recognize that it was written at a certain time.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. But it's, I just shrug. Shrugging is more useful sometimes.
Is this the first antique
book? No.
No.
No. They were married already to Jewish women, and they abandoned them.
Yes.
There's a melatonin issue.
Okay. How long were the Shemites there?
Sorry?
How long were the Shemites there in Israel?
The Jews have been back in Israel for decades already.
So is there anybody that just says that it was those Jews that had stayed?
Well, I think that's that had remained in Israel? That I have not seen.
Right.
That I had not seen, no. No. The assumption is that this is the first wave of Jews who returned to the land. You don't have to assume that this medrash is meant literally.
Yeah.
You know, the darkening by the sun is an image we see in Tanakh. You can look at the beginning of Shir HaShirim for one example. This does not necessarily need to be taken on a literal level. But let's take a look at what Malachi actually said. Moshe.
But on a literal level, I just read this recently, I can't remember where. The concept could very well be that their wives worked in the fields all day. Those were their wives who worked. On the other hand, they had wives of pleasure, and these would have been wives of pleasure. The
Right. So you're harking back to what we discussed last Wednesday in the shiur on marriage and divorce at Beth Emeth. We talked about then the Torah has a deep condemnation of this sort of practice in the story of Ada and Sila. Right, which is a story that people generally don't know. They generally skip. It's chapter 4 of Bereishit. So it has the misfortune of being between exile from the garden, Cain killing Havel, and then the flood. So seriously, who's paying attention to Lemech, Adah, and Zila? Especially because no one can understand what Lemech is talking about when he complains to them. But Lemech has two wives, Adah and Zila. And to make a short story even shorter, Adah, as a Hebrew/Aramaic word, refers to pregnancy. And Sila refers to beauty. And the idea, as Rashi takes it there in chapter 4, is that he had two wives. One was for beauty, and one is the one to have kids. And the first of all, it doesn't work, because Sila ends up having children. But second, and more important, is that the Torah condemns that kind of of an approach, and their marriage breaks down, and that's what you see happen in that story. And it's meant to be a statement that this isn't the way you're supposed to do things. But could that be what's going on here? Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, it's clearly an early stage polemic against that kind of practice, suggesting that there was an issue that needed to be polemicized against.
Yeah, but when Bernard described in the Tanakh, their virtue is that they are beautiful. That isn't the first thing we say about the men who were important men.
Ask Yosef. Ask Daniel.
But you know, a woman, one of her virtues.
There are handsome men in Torah.
Yeah, but the women always have to look.
Those four, they don't.
Okay, this is not the women in Tanakh Shia right now. As enjoyable as that would be, it's not what we're doing right now. Maybe after we finish Nehemiah. Let's take a look at Malachi, because he's waiting. Chapter 2, sentences 10 to 16. It's again page 1431. His rebuke, right? Halo av echad lechulanu. Halo kel echad bira anu. Do not we have one Father, one God created us? Madua nivgad ish be'achiv l'chalel bris avoseinu. Why does one person betray his brother to desecrate the covenant of our ancestors? Bagda Yehuda. Yehuda, Judea, has acted as traitors. V'stoeva ne'esesav Yisrael v'Yerushalayim. Toeva, that which is abhorred, has been performed in Yerushalayim, in Yisrael, in Jerusalem. Kichilel Yehuda Kodesh Hashem. Judea has desecrated that which is sacred to God. Asher Ahe, who he had loved. Uva'al Bas El Nechar. and has lived with the daughter of a foreign god. So what is Judea desecrating here? Clearly you could see this image as just being an image of, we have desecrated our covenant with God, meaning we haven't followed God and worshipped idols. But the commentators universally take this as also referring to what happens within the marriages, which is to say that, as Radak says, they have desecrated the sacredness of marriage by doing this. And Malachi says, Yachreis Hashem lo'ish asher ya'asena er va'onem me'ohale Yaakov u'magish minchal Hashem tzvakot. He says, may God eliminate from this person any descendant. The person who does this is going to suffer. Sorry?
That's a curse.
Yes, that is a curse. And then he continues, I'm not going through every aspect of the verses, we're not relearning Malachi right now. But v'zos she'nis ta'asu, you do this second thing. And that's what the Medrash was referring to before. What do you mean you do this second thing? So the Medrash here says, second after ancient history. After what happened when the Jews were on their way into the land originally, coming out of the Midbar, of the desert, Ibn Ezra and Radak both disagree and say that this is your second sin. Your first sin was that you bring poor quality offerings to God, which Malachi has spoken about separately. In the passage right before this, in chapter 2 in Malachi, he spoke about the offerings that they brought to God, and now he is condemning them for the intermarriage, and says that's what causes God to turn away from your karbanot. Rashi has another take. Yeah.
Why just Judah?
Because that's where we are.
But were the other ones also pure? Like as if Judah's the only one.
It's Judea.
Judea.
That's the area that we settled for the most part. You don't have much outside of Judea.
Okay.
Rashi and Abarbanel say that what's going on is that there are two levels of harm. There's the first harm, which is to the Jewish people, to the religion, the macro type of harm, and then there's the personal harm of what you're doing to your wives by doing this. That's why Rashi and Abarbanel read this, and they continue with sentence 13. This is the second thing you do. Kasos dimaes mizbach Hashem. The tears cover the altar of God, and that was the reference in the Midrash that we read about them going to the altar and crying. It's pulled out of this verse. Their tears cover the altar. Bechiva anaka, crying and wailing. May ein od penosel hamincha v'lakachas ratzon miyadchem. God is not going to be interested in anything you have to say or any offering you want to bring, having done this. And he continues to say, va'amartem alma. And when you, like a guy, you say, what have I done? Al ki Hashem he'id beincha ubein eishes ni'urecha asherata bagadata ba. Because God testifies between you and the wife of your youth whom you have betrayed. Vehi chavertecha ve'eshes brisecha. She is your companion. She is the wife of your covenant. Velo echad asa. This verse is very hard to translate. This next one, sentence 15. We're just going to go with the art school one in the interest of time, but there's a lot more that you could do with this. The recordings from the Malachi Shiurim are on YU Torah. If you want to look online, you'll see, you know, what else we said. I assume on Kosher Tuba. Did we do Kosher Tuba in those days? No. Okay, so on YU Torah you have it. But the Kosher Tube site has relaunched. I will let you know, so you can go catch these shiur. V'lo echad asa ush'ar ruach lo u'maha echad mevakesh zera elokim. V'nishmartem v'ruchachem u've'eshes ni'urecha al yivgod, as they translated here. But did not the unique one do so? Yeah, I can't even read that. Ibn Ezra says the way to translate this line is, not one of you acts properly. That's the way that he renders it. Lo echad asa, not one of you acts properly, having sha'ar ruach, a proper spirit, remain within him. Umaha echad mevakesh zera elokim, to seek zera elokim, to seek the seed of God instead of the seed of these foreign nations. Kisane shalach amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. And again, this verse also is not so simple to translate. Radak renders it as Kisane, if you hate them, shalach, then divorce them. So says the God of Israel. The Chisach Hamasa Levusho Amar Hashem Tzvakos Benishmartem Bruchachem Velosiv Godu. The point is, don't be treacherous to them. keeping them, and at the same time taking this foreign wife, this is Hamas. This is an act of violence to them. That's Malachi's rebuke to the men.
Why doesn't it use this when people don't want to give a gift?
It uses this and much stronger when people don't want to give a get. Whether they're successful or not is another story. And no, I'm not tackling the question of a particular Beit Din. No, I just don't know enough, to be honest. I know the side against. I don't know the side for. Yes, Francis.
Refers to the uniqueness of Abraham, the Tagar and Sarah.
Sorry, who does?
The unique one.
Yeah.
You're referring to Abraham.
Yeah, that's...
Sarah, is that an sort of like a
cop-out? No, I don't think it's a cop-out at all. I mean, this is a hard sentence to render. Rashi says that it's Adam and Chava, that it's referring to. So you have multiple ways to take it, because it's just it's a really hard sentence to work with. Susan?
If they have more than one wife,
yes.
So if they have more than one wife, he's talking, we'll get rid of her. But he could have three other wives. Like, it's as if it's talking like it's a monogamy, but it's not. It's, and because, like, yes, you shouldn't have a non-Jewish wife, but they could have had seven Jewish wives.
Right.
And, but the way he's referring to it is as if it's only one woman.
Right.
As opposed to the polygamy of the time.
Right. I think it's a well-taken point. This is, at this stage in history, a polygamous society. You know, whether it was widespread in practice or not, we have zero way of knowing. Meaning that we know that Jews stopped doing it at some point, long before Ibn Gershom comes along. Meaning, if you look through the Talmud, you will not find a single case of a sage who is polygamous. The only thing you get that's close is that when Rav would travel in the 3rd century, and Rav would travel from place to place to place hearing cases and serving as a circuit judge. So they would assign a woman who could be the woman he could marry, theoretically. It was supposed to be a means of helping him to keep himself in check. In other words, he knows there's always a possibility here, and therefore it decreases the desire. What's called in the Gemara, pas besalo. But we don't have a single case of a Talmudic sage who's polygamous. I don't know what stage it stops being popular practice. In terms of your specific question, though, and I'll get to Shana, the insistence from the beginning, when you look in Parshat Mishpatim, in Shmot, chapter 21, 22, the insistence from that point is that in the event that he's going to marry another wife, it is not going to be at the expense of the first. Both in terms of material things that he's supposed to provide, she'er, ksut, ona, living with her, but also in terms of standing within the home, that was always the understanding. And I think the sense here, reflected in that midrash that we saw, is that the Jewish wife ends up being less than. If you go back to Sarah and Hagar, you know, that kind of one is up and the other is down type of a position, which wasn't unique to us, meaning Hammurabi in his code discusses the same exact phenomenon of taking a second wife, and what do you do if the second wife degrades the first? So I think that's really what Malachi is speaking to. Shaina?
So two things. One is the whole business of polygamous religions. It's true that men among Israel were allowed to have second wives, but there's not a single happy example anywhere.
Correct.
It's always a failure.
Right. There's no good case of polygamy in Tanakh. You will not find a single case where it works out well. The reason why you have it is simply because when you have a Torah which begins with bear fruit and multiply, you're not going to prohibit that which makes maximum fruit, so to speak, possible. The reality is that's what you have. Meaning, if you say that the male is not able to impregnate more than one woman for this period of pregnancy, and then generally speaking, nursing, you've locked up all of your fertilizers for that period of time. Therefore, you're not going to prohibit it. But what ends up happening, as Shana notes, you don't have any. You have loads of cases of unhappy relationships early on in Tanakh. You have some unhappy ones further along as well, right? If you think of the cases of David and his wives and Shlomo and his wives, you know, you don't have good stories. All through Shoftim, you find unhappy polygamies and unhappy children resulting from those polygamies. It's not a pretty picture.
Okay.
Yes, David.
I think one of the issues, one of the differences here is that polygamy, when it's involving Jewish women, will not drive the husband towards idol worship. Whereas when it's a non-Jewish woman, the marriage is leaving the...
So David reads Abarbanel's mind. Abarbanel is bothered as he looks at this. Why is it that it's only the men who are the bad guys? Are you really going to tell me that Jewish women didn't marry non-Jewish men? And he says, you bet. That's exactly what's going on. Take a look at source number 8. Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. Velo ha'eshimam hanavipo. Velo gamkin b'sefer Ezra. He's commenting on Malachi. He says, the prophet does not rebuke them here, meaning in Malachi, and he doesn't rebuke them in Ezra either. Shayunosim b'nosehem l'goyim, for having their daughters marry non-Jewish men. Ki imshayu lokhim lahem nashim nachuyot, only that they would take non-Jewish wives for their sons. Ulai hayu osim zeh. He says, you know why? Because they were misguided. The men thought that they were going to take non-Jewish wives and they weren't going to be influenced. But the Jewish women, the wickedness of the generation did not reach the point where they would go to non-Jewish men. Because they knew they knew, he says, maybe it's not exactly what you were saying, they knew that if she would go into the home, she would end up being pulled, even against her will, into the service of the husband's idolatry. So therefore they wouldn't go there. The men thought, we're not going to be influenced, and they were wrong. But that, he says, is a psychology behind what they did. Then he adds this other note, which harks back to Shimon and Levi. Gam shecherpa haya lahem laseses b'noseihem l'isha sherlo orla. Right? Shimon and Levi said to the people of Shechem, you don't have a bris milah, we can't possibly take you in. So this resonated in their day, and therefore they wouldn't intermarry. That's a remarkable idea. Either way, what is very clear in Malachi and in Ezra is that they're both criticizing the practice specifically of the men marrying non-Jewish women. Now, this is going to come back into our discussion. We're not ready for it yet when we deal with the issue of matrilineal descent.
Yes.
Right? Ezra's major emphasis is the Jewish men marrying non-Jewish women and producing children who are halachically not Jewish. So we're going to have to come back to this point when we get to a discussion of matrilineal descent, which is good because it means I can push it off. The other major question, yeah?
I was just going to say, a quick simple answer to that is that chances are if a woman married a non-Jewish man, she stayed behind in Israel.
Right.
And I think that would be...
Right, certainly if they're Babylonian. Certainly if the intermarriage has occurred in Babylon as opposed to here. But I think that is true in general. I mean, that's the story behind many of the laws and stories we see in Tanakh. That the women would join the man's family. Correct, and that's the issue in inheritance. It's the issue in many issues in the Torah. And therefore, yes, I think that is a driver here.
Is it Samaritans that we're talking about they're marrying?
Assuming that they're marrying in the land, it's some variation of Samaritans. Right. Remember, we said there are multiple nationalities that are floating around in the Shomron.
Right.
So which one they are, I couldn't tell you. But yes, that's if we assume that the intermarriages are happening locally, then yes, these are the Samaritans into whom they are marrying. I mean, this as a phenomenon is not a new phenomenon for Jews. Right? We have all of these rabbinic laws that are designed to reduce social interaction between Jews and those who are not Jewish because of the recognition that when you get to know people, you realize they're not bad people. There are moral Jews and there are moral non-Jews, and there are people who are fun to talk to and have a great sense of humor who aren't Jewish. And once you have that, once you have the recognition that there isn't all that much from a personality basis that's going to separate us, and the only thing you have to keep us, in the fold, so to speak, is to say, well, I want to have Jewish children, and I want them raised by somebody who values Judaism, and therefore I want to find a Jewish spouse, then for someone who doesn't have that as their top value, they're going to marry somebody else. This isn't, far from a new story. So, you know, that's, you know, and especially if they're not, you know, blackened by the sun. That's Medrash. But that's the reality. So what we have to discuss next, and I'm, you know, looking behind me at the time here, recognizing that we're not going to finish this topic, but what you have to also discuss here is, what exactly was the prohibition for them against intermarriage? That's a major, major question, because the people they married are not Canaanites. Certainly if they married in Babylon, they're not Canaanites. But even if they married among the Samaritans here, we have a tradition, which the Talmud goes to great lengths to discuss, that Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, who destroys the 10 tribes, right? He exiles the 10 tribes, in general transfers populations to the point where you have no idea who anybody is. They can say they're Egyptian, they can say they're Girgashi, they can say they're whatever they are, but from a halachic standpoint, they don't have that standing. And so therefore the question is, when the Torah tells you not to marry among the nations of the land that you're about to enter, does that mean any nation? Or does it mean Canaanites? In which case, they haven't broken the law. In which case, we then have to ask, so what is Ezra doing, right? Why is this going to be such a big deal in the rest of Ezra and Nehemiah? So, realistically, we don't have time to do this in depth, or, you know, at all. But know that this is not the first time we've seen somebody inveigh against intermarriage in Tanakh, right? Give me an earlier case in which that was an issue. Well, I'm not going to discuss pre-Sinai, because pre-Sinai, there is no such thing as a Jewish people. There's no covenant. So you can marry Rivka, or you could marry, you know, Basmat, and either way, they're just as non-Jewish as you are. There's no such thing. Yeah. Right. Pinchas and the daughters of Moab, right? Pinchas kills Zimri, and his action is approved of in the Torah. You know, that tells you that there's an issue. And those aren't Canaanites, by the way. Shimshon, on the other hand, takes foreign wives. There's a lot of discussion. Did they convert first? Did they not convert first? Right? Shlomo HaMelech has his political marriages. There's discussion of conversion. There are challenges here in terms of understanding what exactly was the prohibition before this time. And what we're going to see is that to say that there was no biblical prohibition against this is far from heretical. Meaning that when you talk to people who haven't studied the topic, that's their assumption that, well, of course there's a biblical prohibition. What we're going to see next week is that it's not simple and not straightforward at all. So, once again, we do not have class next week. So you have to remember all of this for 2 weeks from now. Thank you very much.